the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you the first program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Bob Bright. So you and Alan used to put on little shows. Did you feel like you had a voice, or didn't even think about it? You just sang?
I just did it, yeah.
Can you recall when you the first time you actually thought, actually, this does sound good, and actually wanted to be a singer?
No.
It just evolved?
The year I was leaving school, my other friend, Michael Starbanoff, was one of the German kids that I befriended in grade four. We'd known each other and went through high school. He used to play men's basketball.
Right.
And occasionally I'd go down and watch him of a Saturday afternoon. One time they didn't have enough players, so I was subbed in to be a player for the day. Got best player on the court. No, I'm not. I was quite athletic when I was young. You know, I just used to go for it.
Wow.
And if you go for it, you sometimes get it. Anyway, he came to me one day. He said, oh, we've got a breakup social at Forestville Stadium. Do you want to come tonight, you know? So I was still of an age where one had to ask one's parents.
Of course.
You know, so can I go? Oh, yeah, okay then. And it's possibly the first time I was allowed out by myself of a night time, think back, you know. And it was the first time I ever saw or drank alcohol.
Memorable moment.
Green Creme de Menthe.
Oh,
that looks very nice.
Oh, dear. Oh dear.
So anyway, I remember having a couple of those, and then I don't remember whether I was asked or not, but I doubt that I was. I found myself on stage singing with the band that was there.
Right. And it worked?
Well, it must have, because the next day I got a telegram saying, be at the Palais Saturday afternoon, talent quest, anonymous. So I don't know. Okay, I'll go to the Palais. So off to the Palais I went. Talent quest, yeah. Why? Because television was just starting in Adelaide. They were looking for talent. So there was the talent quest for the teen show that they were planning. And Johnny O'Keefe was the judge.
Oh, how cool was that?
Yeah.
And how scary.
And exactly. That's
right.
Well, I've got to do it now because I've told everyone I'm going to be here.
Yeah.
So anyway, I sang Johnny Be Good, not through any, I didn't even know that Johnny O'Keefe was involved. But yeah. It's an ironic choice of songs when things were done that way.
Did you back yourself or did you?
No, there was a band. Okay. It was probably the Penny Rockets.
Okay.
Probably was, because they were Ivan's sort of stock band, you know. So anyway, I won that. And the prize was to be on television next week. So I basically went from having this little dream that maybe I could strum this tennis racket and be a singer, to actually having to go to the television
station.
That's
a mighty big leap, isn't it?
Well,
especially for a young boy.
It is, you know. And it's like when we left England, you know, my mother said, yeah, and actually I was sad, you know, like I'm going away, I'm leaving everything I know, how do I handle this? And she just sort of, I can't remember her exact words, but the thought was like, you just have to forget that was, and start again. It's like a line and you step over it and this is my new life now, you know. And I've tended to use that anytime I'm confronted with something new. You go, oh, well, this is the start.
Your mum actually, and I'd like to talk a bit more about this later in the interview, but your mum actually was really good with small philosophies, wasn't she?
Oh, she was
had
excellent.
A lot of things that influenced you over your life.
Yeah,
and this was one of them.
Definitely.
So you stepped over that line.
I stepped over the line, sang the song. You know, the vagaries of television when it started was that no one really, there were no real rules, you know. I mean, the first thing I loved and was told, you better get your makeup on. Makeup room's over there. So you go to the makeup room and it's just a room with a bench and this pancake.
You're supposed to put on
various colours and sponges. It dawned on me. There's no one else around.
Oh, yeah. Sugar.
Well, you know, I'd seen my mum powder her face, but
this is, boggles the game.
Yeah, this is a whole strange experience for a 15-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I actually went and asked, well, how do you do this? You know, you just wet the sponge, squeeze it out, put tomatoes, scrub it on your face. So I did.
At least it wasn't colour.
No, exactly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just amazed people didn't think I was Indigenous for my first television appearance. But nonetheless, it all worked and I got booked back on the show and, you know, I became a relative regular on what's called Woody's Teen Time.
Now, you're born Robert, weren't you?
I was.
Were you Bobby all your life or did it start?
All my life I've been Bob. I was named after my... The day, 2 days I think it was, before I was born, my mother's brother, whose name was Bob, crashed in a plane off of Malta during the war. Right. You know, he was a gunner. I know, he was a, what do they call him? The guy that plots the course.
Navigator.
On, I think, Lancaster bombers, I think. Anyhow, he died. Now, so I was basically named as in honour of him.
Bob, yeah.
Which when people say to me, well, yeah, and Bob's your uncle, I say, yeah, I'm glad it was, because if he hadn't have been, I'd have been Harry. Because that was a plan to... Well, Harry's a cool name these days, but yeah, it was not then, cool in 1956.
No.
So,
So when did Bob become Bobby?
Bob became Bobby when I started to sing and I'd ring people up and leave a message. Oh, it's Bob Bright here. So I'd get inquiry back. Is Mr. Wright there? Bob Bright.
Oh.
Bob Bright.
Right, Bob Wright.
Yeah. So, Bobby Bright, then I'll know I'm Bright.
Yes.
So that's how I started
to
use... That's how the stage name Bobby Bright came about. I still think of myself as Bob, always have, and people that know me gradually realise I'm not Bobby.
No, well, I have trouble calling you Bobby.
I think
it was Bob.
Yeah. So,
and so it started in Adelaide.
Yeah. When I was about 15, 16,
Most people, most musicians or most people that get on television as musicians or singers start with a band and progress to television. You've gone from basically nobody to being straight on television.
Yeah.
When did you start working with a band then?
My first effort at forming a band, I really can't recall who it was or anything, but it was called The Downbeats. And nothing happened, you know, it was sort of just one of those couple of rehearsals and around.
Yeah.
And then I somehow met up with Doug Ashdown and we talked about forming a band and we called it the Bowmen, B-A-U-M-E, as in beautiful men,
yes,
Bowmen.
Yes.
And Brian Davidge was the bass player. He still plays around Adelaide quite a lot, actually. He's still active. Me, Doug Ashdown, Brian... Rhythm guitar player called Norm Keddie, I think. And I really can't remember who the drummer was. You know, the name Keith Drage comes to mind, but I know he wasn't the first drummer that we had. Anyhow.
So it's a strict rock band?
Yeah, this was Shadows, Cliff Richard.
Yeah, so we're still late 50s, early 60s, aren't we?
Yeah, we're still, 59, 60.
Yeah.
We used to play, you know, we'd rehearse once a week and play at various places. We used to play at a place called the Octagon in Elizabeth, which is a sort of satellite city for English migrants. I can remember playing there once and this little bloke's come up and saying, you mind if me and me mates sing vocal backing? No, that's all right. And they were one of these bands, you know, just
all the moves.
All the steps and clan claps. And anyway, that young kid's name was Glenn Shorrock.
Oh, how cool.
And the other, there was him and three others. Paddy was definitely one of the other guys, and I don't recall who the other two were. Mm. But that was the colonel, the original colonel of what became the Twilight. They called themselves the Twilights in there.
Even then.
But later on they got together with the band and became the Twilights, you know. But yeah, so...
So having them backing you as a vocal backing would have worked.
Oh, it was great.
Those guys could sing.
Yeah. No, they were good. In fact, we made inquiries about making a record and, the recording industry was very, very young in those days.
Very basic, too.
Remember?
Yeah.
I can remember the lounge room where we were set up with the drums covered in sheets so that they weren't too loud for the tape machine. And anyway, when we were sitting around discussing, it was like, how much is this going to cost? Oh, that'll be £15.
That was a lot of money, though.
Well, it was. I mean, my first job, I think, was making £9 a month. A week.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So we'll come to that in a second then, about your work. So £9 a week. Did you get the £15 together or did you say thanks?
No, what we did was said, I don't know who's it, probably Brian Davidge said, mate, why don't we get the Twilights in on it? Then I'll be four extra people.
To pay for the bill. Smart boy.
So the first record that both myself and Glenn Shorrock ever made was me singing Donna, that Richie Valens song, on one side with the, you know, ooh, Donna, ooh, all those things.
Very popular style at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with, you know, the more hardcore rock and roll sort of getting... being given the short shift because of all the problems in the States with payola. You know, let's
get the doo-wop here.
So
anyway, and the other side, the flip side was an instrumental. It was Doug Ashdown playing that old classical fleur-de-lis.
Did you guys ever get a copy?
They're as rare as Rockinghurst.
You don't have one?
I don't have
one.
Wow,
how wonderful that
would be. I believe Glenn Shorrock may have one because I know that the bass player from the Twilights had a copy, and I think he must have had Glenn's copy.
Right.
But no, I gave my copy to my friend Michael Starbanoff, and he died years ago.
Yeah.
He knows what happened. But Doug was playing fleur-de-lis in that, you know, remember The Ventures?
Yes. One of my favourite groups.
Well, so that was our first record, Next.
Well, we talked about the fact that it costs money, and I was going to say, you obviously we're not making that much money you could survive as a musician. You'd left school. What were you doing to earn money?
My first job was with an advertising agency called Ring Stacy, and that job was to basically ride a bike around delivering various, what used to be called stereos, like those days if you had an ad in the paper, you'd get these sort of lead, like say it was for frying pans, you'd have a little lead block with a picture of a frying pan on it.
Right.
And they're all the, can't remember what they were called. Anyway, these things would all then be put into a printer's block to make a page, you know.
Oh,
so you had to deliver. So I'd deliver all that sort of stuff to the advertiser and the news and the various places around. I'll pick up stuff from...
You obviously didn't see that at the time as your career.
No, although it wasn't very long there before I was hanging out with the creatives. You know, he'd walk past the guy's office and he'd be standing on his desk dropping a paperclip with a parachute attached to the ground and watching it. And what's he on to? You know, he'd be working out some toy to put in a breakfast cereal.
Okay.
So it wasn't long before I was hanging out with those guys more than the accountants, you know.
Did you get into any work in that field or...?
No, but I did see how it worked. But and that lasted, I think, till... Basically, I think I was there about 18 months.
Oh, that was a fairly long stint.
Yeah, it was good. I got the bullet because... so did everybody else, you know. There was a real glitch in the economic cycle called the, what do they call it in those days? Credit squeeze.
Yeah. So time moves on because we're moving into the 60s, which was a great period of change, maybe socially, arts-wise, but certainly music-wise.
Yeah.
Were you still in Adelaide when the British beat music hit Australia?
No.
What brought you to Melbourne?
To Melbourne. Well... after that job, I got fired. I worked for about a month in a little electrical distributor, but I was working as an accountant, you know, just tapping out numbers, and I hated it.
Yeah.
It was too much like school. I'm sitting there, and there's this guy in a desk in front watching me, you know, I went, what? So I lasted about a month, gave notice. And as Dame Fortune would have had it, Ivan Damon at that stage, who was a big dance promoter in Adelaide. He had originally arranged the talent quest that I won, and I had gone on to do a couple of little local tours for him and flown to Mount Gambier to do stuff, various employees. And he decided to come to Melbourne and opened up two dance halls, one Mailing Road, Canterbury, in the old theatre, and the Preston Circle, which was, he bought two picture theatres and took the seats out.
So he actually bought them?
Yeah.
Wow, that was okay.
And
serious.
So, would I like to come to Melbourne and sing, you know? So, I still I was only like just 17, so they,
yeah.
Said to my mum, what do you reckon? Should I, you know, can I go? What do you, and she just looked at me again, one of the, she just said, look, you know, if you don't do it now, you'll regret it for the rest of your life, so you better go and do it. So there it was, bang.
So you lived in Melbourne. Where did you end up?
I ended up for the first month. We used to drive across for the Thursday from Adelaide, and Ivans, he had a red main line, which was this sort of station wagon version of a custom line. So it had big silver fins at the back, bright red.
Yeah, right, you're arriving in Stockholm.
And we'd drive from Adelaide to Melbourne in 5 hours, you know.
Wow.
120 miles per hour, not kilometres, we're talking miles per hour. But of course, no trucks on the road stuff like that.
No speed cameras.
No. So anyway, after about a month of every Thursday coming to Melbourne and we'd work, Canterbury Ballroom Thursday night, Mariana All Sunshine went Friday night, Preston Circle Saturday night, drive back to Adelaide on Sunday. Thursday come back there. And I just said, look, is there somewhere? He said, yeah, well, you can stay at the theatre, you know, Mailing Road if you want. So the first month or two after that, I lived in one of the projection booths at the old Mailing Road Theatre, you know. But the first night or two I was there, I slept on a sofa in front of a radiator because it didn't have any blankets.
So cold,
Anyhow, so that was how I came to Melbourne. Then I finally got a little flat in Preston. That was about when the British invasion hit. And I'd recorded for W&G because when I came from Adelaide, I had a letter of introduction to Stan Rofe from an Adelaide DJ, Bob Francis.
Yes.
So anyway, Stan arranged for me through Ron Tudor to have a contract with W&G.
So Stan took to you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that opens just about every door in Melbourne, doesn't it?
Entirely, entirely. He did take me home, and I said, back off. Stan was that way, but he never again brought it up or attempted, and made my career.
He made a lot of people's careers. He may have been many things, but he knew his music.
Hmm. And he loved it.
He did.
He actually found the song, you know. First record was a Buddy Holly type rip-off. Never knew a girl like my little Sheila. Her love drive me insane. Can't remember, Tommy something or other. Anyway, he had a new release standout of his, and it's called There's a Great Day Coming Tomorrow, and that was my first record for W&G. But to get a contract with W&G, because basically they were publishers, recording was a secondary industry.
That's right.
So you had to write at least one side of anything that you recorded. So that was my first attempt at writing songs, you know. I mean, I'd always written doggerel, you know, long poems and silly shit, but okay, I've got to write a song. So I did. I wrote a cringeworthy song people write when you're 16, 17. Yeah. Girls never know, it's me.
Hey, you had to start something.
Exactly. So, that was, bang. I'd started doing a few more dances around outside of just the Ivans dances to promote, you know.
Because you're really fortunate, aren't you? I mean, you've got a lot of talent. But at the same time, it's exploding in Melbourne. Venues are opening up everywhere.
Oh.
The kids want to hear their own music.
Oh, yeah. No, it was entirely the right time. You know, you couldn't do it today.
Oh, no. That period can never be repeated.
No, that's right.
So, I mean, most people will associate you, rightly or wrongly, with Laurie.
Yeah.
How did you and Laurie meet? We're talking about...
Yeah. Okay, Laurie played in a band called Blue Jays. And the Blue Jays were the resident band at the Mailing Road Thursday night gig. And after the gig, it was a tradition that Ivan brought over from Adelaide. Whenever you did a gig of his in Adelaide, all the various bands and singers from the various venues you had around Adelaide would meet behind the zoo in Adelaide. I mean, Adelaide's pretty small. Wherever you are, you can be there in 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
You know? So wherever you were, you could always make it to the zoo after your gig. And the rule at the zoo club was, if you talk business, you'll get a bucket of water on your head. Now, this is to let steam off and not get into business. So anyway, Ivan started doing that here, you know. So we'd sit around afterwards, and Laurie would say to me, "Do you know so-and-so, it'd be an Everly Brothers song. Can you sing that? Because I really love singing the harmony." And Laurie played the guitar, you know, so he'd launch in, and I'd just sing, and he'd sing harmony, which is what he liked doing.
Mm.
And people would come see, "You guys are good together. Why don't you think of doing something?" You know, we'd go, "We're solo artists." Yes. Right? Can't you tell?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
But after a while, we did succumb, and we'd do gigs where we'd do a bracket each and then sing two or three songs at the end of the night together. Well, that was going all right. And then we got a gig doing it with a band called The Hearsemen, which Mike Brady was in.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that, no.
And by this stage... And Laurie had been entertaining since he was about 8 or 9. You know, he used to tour around with Society for the Blind. He used to run these concerts all around Victoria, put on to make money for the blind school. And Laurie had been part of that for years and years, you know. So he knew about entertainment, not just country and western or whatever. And he said, "Why don't we do something like a Screaming Lord Sutch type thing, you know?" So we started putting our heads together, and we decided we'd work with the Hearsemen, and Laurie had come out in Top Hat and Tails, and the Hearsemen would carry on this coffin, and in the coffin would be me, made up with green makeup and teased out hair and a long black shroud on. And Laurie would sing a couple of songs, and then he'd go into, "Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Smoke, smoke, smoke until you smoke yourself to death. Oh, something that I wait. Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that I gotta have another cigarette." So anyway, so halfway through this, they'd be a bit more rocked up
of course.
That, but halfway through, I would push up the lid of the coffin, and one hand would come out, and I'd start marauding people, you know, basically running around, picking up young girls out of the audience and holding them above my head, whatever, doing this. Ultimate craziness, and we did it at Festival Hall, and I got a little bit too rambunctious and broke two of their microphones, apparently.
Whoops.
So they impounded our coffin. No, you can't have your coffin back.
Oh dear.
The coffin that we used to keep at Laurie's place, but we were only allowed to bring it in the back way because his grandmother lived in the front room, and should she see a coffin coming in, she'd worry. So they impounded our coffin, and we had the big show coming up.
Right.
It was Friday the 13th in Heidelberg, and it was the big show, this one, you know. What are we going to do? So there we are, driving up and down High Street, Preston and Northcote, all around there, knocking on funeral parlours, asking,
I suppose you
could put a coffin we could borrow for an evening. We finally found one.
Oh, you really got one that way?
Yeah, we really got one that way. And the guys, "You'd have to have it back by tomorrow because they need it." and it was much more comfortable than the one we did.
Oh, that
it was. It was all padded and everything.
Yeah.
Cruising. Yeah, so...
So that was a good show.
Yeah, that all worked, but, you know, it was kind of silly, but it was fun.
Yeah, but it had a limited lifespan.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Yeah.
But by that, I mean, I think it was around about that time that the Go Show started, and we were offered to be on that. The first one I was on by myself, Laurie was sick, I think, which he used to... I mean, he'd always had terrible asthma all his life. So I was on the first Go Show, but then they launched Go Records, and we were... Go 001, we were the first recording artists on the Go label. And that was I Belong With You.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.